Chapter 22. Travels with my father. The first time I went travelling with my father was when I was much younger. We attended the opening night of King Lear at the Globe in 1602. The place was dirty and smelly and slightly rowdy, but for all that, not unlike a lot of other opening nights I had attended. We bumped into someone named Bendix Scintilla, who was, like my father, a lonely traveller in time. He said he hung around in Elizabethan England to avoid Chronogard patrols. Dad said later that Scintilla had been a truly great fighter for the cause, but his drive had left him when they eradicated his best friend and partner. I knew how he felt, but did not do as he did. Thursday next, private diaries. Dad turned up for breakfast. I was just flicking through that morning's copy of The Toad at the kitchen table when he arrived. The big news story was the vault face in Yorick Kane's fortunes. From being a sad, politically dead no-hoper, he was polling ahead of the ruling Tea-First Party, the power of Shakespeare. The world suddenly stopped, the picture on the TV froze up, and the sound became a dull hum, the same tone and pitch as it was the moment Dad arrived. He had the power to stop the clock like this. Time ground to a halt when he visited me. It was a hard-won skill. For him, there was no return to normality. "Hello, Dad," I said brightly. "How are things?" "Well, it depends," he replied. "Have you heard of Winston Churchill yet?"
"Not yet."
"Blast," he muttered, sitting down and raising his eyebrows at the newspaper headline. "Chimp merely pet," claims Croquet Supremo. "How's your mother?"
"She's well. Is the world still going to end next week?"
"Looks like it.
Does she ever talk about me?"
"All the time. I got this report from Spec Ops Forensics."
"Hmm,"
said my father, donning his glasses and reading the report carefully.
"Carboxy methyl cellulose, phenylalanine and hydrocarbons, animal fat. Doesn't make any sense at all."
He handed back the report.
"I don't get it," he said quietly, sucking the end of his spectacles. "That cyclist lived and the world still ended. Maybe it's not him. Trouble is, nothing else happened at that particular time and place."
"Yes, it did," I said in a sober voice.
"What?"
I picked up the evidence bag with the pink goo inside. "You gave me this." Dad snapped his fingers.
"That must be it. My handing you the bag of slime was the key event and not the death of the cyclist. Did you tell anyone where that pink goo came from?"
"No one." He thought for a bit.
"Well," he said at last, "unlike hindsight, avoiding Armageddons is not an exact science. We may have to let events lead us for a while until we can figure it out. How is everything else going?"
"Goliath eradicated Landon," I replied glumly.
"Who?"
"My husband."
"Oh," he said, suddenly thoughtful. "Any particular reason?"
"Goliath wants jack shit out of the Raven."
"Ah," he exclaimed. "The old blackmail routine. I'm sorry to hear that, sweet pea, but listen, don't be downhearted. We have a saying about reactualizing eradicates that goes like this. No one is truly dead until they are forgotten."
"So?" I answered slowly. "If I forgot about him, then would he be gone?"
"Precisely," remarked my father, helping himself to some coffee. "That's why I'm having so much trouble reactualizing Churchill and Nelson. I have to find someone who remembers them as they were, so I can figure out where things might have gone awry."
He laughed for a moment and then got up.
"Well, get dressed, we're leaving."
"Where to?"
"Where?" he exclaimed. "Why, to get your husband back, of course."
This was good news. I quickly dashed into the bedroom to pull some clothes on while Dad read the paper and had a bowl of cereal.
"Shithouse told me that they had the summer of 1947 sewn up so tight not even a transtemporal gnat could get in there,"
I told him, breathless from preparation.
"Then," replied my father thoughtfully, "we will have to outsmart them. They will expect us to arrive at the right time at the right place, but we won't. We'll arrive at the right place, but at the wrong time. Then simply wait."
"Worth a try, wouldn't you say?" I smiled.
"Definitely."
I was conscious of a series of rapid flashes, and there we were in a blacked-out Humber Snipe,
driving alongside a dark strip of water on a moonlit night. In the distance, I could see searchlights crisscross the sky and the distant thump, thump, thump of a bombing raid. "Where are we?" I asked. Dad changed down a gear. "Approaching Henley-on-Thames in occupied England, November 1946. I looked out at the river again, an uncomfortable feeling starting to develop in the pit of my stomach. Is this where Landon, you know, in the car accident? This is where it happens, but not when. If I were to jump straight there, Lavoisier would be on us like a shot. Ever played kick the can? Sure. It's a bit like that. Guile, stealth, patience, and a small amount of cheating. Okay, we're here." We had reached an area of the road where there was a sharp bend. I could see how an inattentive motorist might easily misjudge the road and end up in the river. I shivered. We got out and Dad walked across the road to where a small group of silver birches stood amidst a tangle of dead bracken and brambles. It was a good place to observe the bend in the road. We were barely 10 yards away. Dad laid down a plastic carrier bag he had brought, and we sat on the grass, leaning up against the smooth bark of a large birch. "Now what?" "We wait for 6 months."
6 months? Dad, are you crazy? We can't sit here for 6 months.
"So little time, so much to learn," mused my father. "Do you want a sandwich? Your mother leaves them out for me every morning. I'm not mad keen on corned beef and custard, but it has a sort of eccentric charm, and it does fill a hole."
6 months, I repeated.
He took a bite from his sandwich.
"Lesson one in time travel, Thursday. First of all, we are all time travellers. The vast majority of us manage only one day per day. Now, if we accelerate ourselves like so..."
The clouds gathered speed above our heads and the trees shook faster in the light breeze. By the light of the moon, I could see that the pace of the river had increased dramatically. A convoy of lorries sped past us in sudden, accelerated movement.
"This is about 20 days per day, every minute compressed into about 3 seconds. Any slower and we would be visible. As it is, an outside observer might think he saw a man and woman sitting at the bottom of these trees. But if he looked again, we would be gone. Ever thought you saw someone and looked again only to find them gone?"
"Sure."
"Chronogard traffic moving through, most likely."
The dawn was breaking and presently a German Wehrmacht patrol found our abandoned car and dashed around looking for us before a breakdown truck appeared and took the car away. More cars rushed along the road and the clouds sped rapidly across the sky.
"Pretty, isn't it?" said my father. "I miss all this. But I have so little time these days. At 50 dapers we would still have to wait a good 3 or 4 days for Landon's accident. I've a dental appointment, so we're going to have to pick it up a bit."
The clouds sped faster. Cars and pedestrians were nothing more than blurs. The shadow of the trees cast by the sun traversed rapidly and lengthened in the afternoon sun. Pretty soon it was evening and the clouds were tinged with pink before the rapidly gathering gloom overtook the day and the stars appeared, followed by the moon, which arced rapidly across the sky. The star spun around the pole star as the sky grew bluer and the early dawn and the sun began its rapid climb in the east.
8 1/2 thousand dapers, explained my father. "This is my favourite bit. Watch the leaves."
The sun now rose and set in under 10 seconds. Pedestrians were invisible to us as we were to them. And a car had to be parked for at least 2 hours for us to see it all. But the leaves... they turned from green to brown as we watched, the outer branches a blur of movement, the river a soft, undulating mirror without so much as a ripple. The plants died off as we watched. The sky grew more overcast and the spells of dark were now much longer than the light. Flecks of light showed along the road where traffic moved, and opposite us, an abandoned Kubelwagen was rapidly stripped of spares and then dumped upside down in the river.
"I'd never get bored of this, Dad. Do you travel like this all the time?"
"Never this slow. This is just for tourists. We usually approach speeds of 10 billion or more dapers. If you want to go backwards, you have to go faster still."
"Go backwards by going forwards faster?" I queried, confounded by the illogicality of it.
"That's enough for now, sweet pea. Just enjoy yourself and watch."
I pulled myself closer to him as the air grew chilly and a heavy blanket of snow covered the road and forest around us.
"Happy New Year," said my father.
"Snowdrops!" I cried in delight as green shoots nuzzled through the snow and flowered, their heads angling towards the low sun. Then the snow was gone and the river rose again and small amounts of detritus gathered around the upturned Kubelwagen, which rusted as we watched. The sun flashed past us higher and higher in the sky, and soon there were daffodils and crocuses.
"Ah," I said in surprise, as a shoot from a small shrub started to grow up my trouser leg.
"Train them away from your body," explained my father, diverting the course of a bramble trying to ensnare him with the palm of his hand.
My own shoot pushed against my hand like a small green worm and moved off in another direction. I did the same with the others that threatened me. But Dad went one further and with a practice hand trained his bramble into a pretty bow.
"I've known students literally rooted to the spot," explained my father. "It's where the phrase comes from. But it can be fun, too. We had an operative named Jekyll who once trained a 400-year-old oak into a heart as a present for her boyfriend."
The air was warmer now, and as my father checked his chronograph again, we started to decelerate. The 6 months we had spent there had passed in barely 30 minutes. By the time we had returned to one day per day, it was night again.
"I don't see anyone, do you?" he hissed.
I looked around. The road was deserted. I opened my mouth to speak, but he put a finger to his lips. At that moment, a Morris 8 saloon appeared around the corner and drove rapidly down the road. It swerved to avoid a fox, skidded sideways off the road and landed upside down in the river. I wanted to get up, but my father held me with a pinched grip. The driver of the car, who I assumed was Bilden, broke the surface of the river, then quickly dived back to the car and resurfaced a few moments later with a woman. He dragged her to the bank and was just about to return to the submerged vehicle when a tall man in a greatcoat appeared from nowhere and placed his hand on Bilden's arm.
"Now,"
said my father, and we dashed from the safety of the copse.
"Leave him,"
yelled my father.
"Leave him to do what he has to do."
My father grabbed the interloper, and with a sharp cry, the man vanished. Bilden looked confused and made a run for the river, but in a few short moments, a half-dozen chronoguard had dropped in, Lavoisier amongst them. One of the agents rugby-tackled Landon's father before he could return to rescue Landon.
I yelled no, and pulled out my gun and aimed it at the man who held Bilden. I yelled no, and pulled out my gun and aimed it at the man who held Bilden. I yelled no and pulled out my gun and aimed it at the man who held Bilden. I yelled no and pulled out my gun and aimed it at the man who held Bilden. I yelled no and pulled out my gun and aimed it at the man who held Bilden.
The next thing I knew, I was disarmed, sitting on the ground and feeling shocked and disoriented after my brief enloopment. It was how I imagine a stuck record might feel. Two SO-12 operatives stared at me while my father and Lavoisier talked in angry voices close by. Bilden was breathing heavily and sobbing into the damp earth, holding his still unconscious wife.
Bastards!
I spat.
My husband's in there!
So much to learn,
muttered Lavoisier as I got to my feet and stood by my father's side.
The infant Park Lane is not your husband. He is an accident statistic, or not. It rather depends on your father.
A lackey for the Goliath Corporation, Lavoisier, said Dad quietly. You disappoint me.
Greater need prevails, Colonel. If you'd handed yourself in, I wouldn't have had to take these extreme measures. Besides, the Chronoguard can't function without corporate sponsorship.
And in return, you do a few favors.
As I said, greater need prevails. And before you start waving charges of corruption at me, this combined Goliath Chronoguard operation has been fully sanctioned by the Chamber. Now it's so simple, even you can understand it. Give yourself up, and your daughter can have her husband back, whether or not she decides to help Goliath. As you can see, I am in a very generous mood.
I looked at Dad and saw him bite his lip. He rubbed his temples and sighed. He had spent years fighting corruption in the Chronoguard, and despite Landon's being so close to reactualization, I wasn't going to see Dad lose his liberty over either of us. What had he said? No one is truly dead until they are forgotten? Landon was still strong in my memory. We would have another chance. As Dad opened his mouth to reluctantly agree, I said, "No."
"What?"
exclaimed Lavoisier. "No," I repeated.
"Dad, don't do it. I'll get jack shit out or something."
Dad smiled and rested his hand on my shoulder.
"Bah!"
went Lavoisier.
"Each as hideously self-righteous as the other."
He nodded to his men, who raised their weapons, but Dad was quick. I felt him grasp my shoulder tightly and we were off. The sun rose quickly as we leapt forward in time, leaving Lavoisier and the others several hours away before they realized what had happened.
"Let's see if we can lose him," muttered my father. "As for that chamber stuff, bullshit. Landon's eradication was murder, pure and simple. In fact, it's just the sort of information I need to bring Lavoisier down."
Days amounted to no more than brief flashes of alternate dark and light as we hurtled into the future. But the odd thing was, we didn't actually move physically from the place we were standing. The world just aged about us.
"We're not at full speed," Dad explained. "He might overtake me without thinking. Keep an eye out for..."
Lavoisier and his cronies appeared for no more than the briefest glimpse as they moved past us into the future. Dad stopped abruptly and I staggered slightly as we returned to real time. We moved off the road as a 50-style truck drove past, horn blaring.
"What now?"
"I think we shook him off. Blast!" We were off again. Lavoisier had reappeared. We lost him for a moment, but pretty soon he was back again, keeping pace with us, matching our speed as we moved through history. As Dad slowed down slightly, so did Lavoisier. As he accelerated, Lavoisier did the same.
"I'm too old to fall for that one,"
smiled Lavoisier. Soon after, two of his cronies reappeared as each one found us and matched the speed we were moving through time.
"I knew you'd come,"
said Lavoisier triumphantly, walking towards us slowly as the time flashed past, faster and faster. A new road was built where we were standing, then a bridge, houses, shops.
"Give yourself up. You'll have a fair trial. Believe me."
The two other Chronoguard operatives grabbed my father and held him tightly.
"I'll see you hang for this, Lavoisier. The Chamber would never sanction such an action. Give Landon back his life, and I promise you I will say nothing." "Well, that's just it, isn't it?"
replied Lavoisier scornfully.
"Who do you think they're going to believe? You, with your record, or me, third in command at the Chronoguard? Besides, your clumsy attempt to get Landon back has covered any tracks I might have made getting rid of him."
Lavoisier aimed his gun at my father. The two Chronoguards held onto Dad tightly to stop him accelerating away, and we buffeted slightly as he tried. Things, to say the least, looked bad. From the makes of the cars on the road, I could see we were approaching the early 80s. It wouldn't be long before we arrived at 1985. I had a sudden thought. Wasn't there Chronoguard industrial action happening sometime soon?
"Say,"
I said, "do you guys cross picket lines?" The Chronoguard agents looked at each other, then at the chronographs on their wrists, then at Lavoisier. The taller of the two was the first to speak.
"She's right, Mr. Lavoisier, sir. I don't mind bullying and killing innocents, and I'll follow you beyond the crunch normally, but..."
"But what?"
asked Lavoisier angrily.
"But I am a loyal Time Guild member. I don't cross picket lines."
"Neither do I,"
replied the other agent, nodding to his friend.
"Likewise and truly."
Lavoisier smiled engagingly.
"Listen here, guys. I'll personally pay."
"I'm sorry, Mr. Lavoisier,"
replied the operative with a hint of indignation,
"but we've been instructed not to enter into any individual contracts."
And in an instant they were gone as December arrived and the world turned pink. What had once been the road was now a few inches of the same pink slime that Dad had shown me. We were beyond the 12th of December 1985. And where before there had been growth, change, seasons, clouds, now there was nothing but a never-ending landscape of shiny, opaque curd.
"Saved by industrial action," said Dad, laughing. "Tell that to your friends at the Chamber."
"Bravo,"
replied Lavoisier wryly. He lowered his pistol. Without his cronies to hold on to Dad and stop him escaping, there was little he could do.
"Bravo. I think we should just say au revoir, my friends, until we meet again."
Do we have to make it au revoir? I asked. What's wrong with goodbye?
He didn't have time to answer as I felt Dad tense and we accelerated faster through the time stream. The pink slime was washed away, leaving only earth and rocks, and as I watched, the river moved away from us, meandered off into the floodplain and then swept under our feet and undulated back and forth like a snake, before finally being replaced by a lake. We moved faster, and soon I could see the earth start to buckle as the crust bent and twisted under the force of plate tectonics. Plains dropped to make seas and mountains rose in their place. New vegetation re-established itself as millions of years swept past in a matter of seconds. Vast forests grew and fell. We were covered, then uncovered, then covered again, now in a sea, now inside rock, now surrounded by an ice sheet, now 100 feet in the air. More forests, then a desert, then mountains rose rapidly in the east, only to be scoured flat a few moments later. Well, said my father as we travelled through time, Lavoisier in the pocket of Goliath, who'd have thought it?
Dad, I asked as the sun grew visibly bigger and redder, how do we get back?
We don't go back, he replied. We can't go back. Once the present has happened, that's it. We just carry on going until we return to where we started, sort of like a roundabout. Miss an exit and you have to drive around again. There are just a few more exits and the roundabout is much, much bigger.
How much bigger?
A lot.
How much of a lot? I persisted.
A lot of a lot.
Quiet now. We're nearly there.
And all of a sudden, we weren't nearly there. We were there. Back at breakfast in my apartment. Dad turning the pages of the newspaper and me running out from my bedroom having just got dressed. I stopped in mid-stride and sat down at the table, feeling deflated.
Well, we tried, didn't we? Said my father.
Yes, Dad, I replied, staring at the floor. We did, thanks.
Don't worry, he said kindly. Even the finest eradications leave something behind for us to reactualize from.
There is always a way.
We just have to find it.
Sweet pea, we will get him back. I'm not having my grandchild without a father.
His determination did reassure me, and I thanked him.
Good, he said, closing his newspaper. By the way, did you manage to get any tickets for the Nolan Sisters concert?
I'm working on it.
Good show. Well, time waits for no man, as we say.
He squeezed my hand and was gone. The world started up again, the TV came back on, and there was a muffled plucking from Pickwick, who had managed to lock herself in the airing cupboard again. I let her out and she ruffled her feathers in an embarrassed fashion before going off in search of her water dish. I went into work, but there was precious little to do. We had a call from an enraged Mrs. Hathaway, 34, demanding to know when we were going to arrest the unlicked bear whelp who had cheated her. And another from a student who wanted to know whether we thought Hamlet's line was, "This too solid flesh," or "This too sullied flesh," or even perhaps this two-toed swordfish. Bowden spent the morning mouthing the lines for his routine, and by noon there had been 2 attempts to steal Cardenio from Vole Towers. Nothing serious. SO-14 had doubled the guard. This didn't concern Spec Ops 27 in any way, so I spent the afternoon surreptitiously reading the jurisfiction instruction manual, which felt a little like flicking through a girl's magazine during school. I was tempted to have a go at entering a work of fiction to try out a few of their handy book-jumping tips, page 28, but Havisham had roundly forbidden me from doing anything of the sort until I was more experienced. By the time I was ready to go home, I had learned a few tricks about emergency book evacuation procedures, page 34, and read about the aims of Bowdlerizers, page 62. Who were a group of well-meaning yet censorious individuals hell-bent on removing obscenities from fiction. I also read about Heathcliff's unexpected 3-year career in Hollywood under the name of Buck Stallion, and his eventual return to the pages of Wuthering Heights, page 71. The 46 abortive attempts to illegally save Beth from dying in Little Women, page 74. Details of the character exchange program, page 81, using holorimic verse to flush out renegade book people, or page runners as they were known, page 96, and how to use spelling mistakes, misprints and double negatives to signal to other PROs in case emergency book evacuation procedures, page 34, failed, page 105. But there weren't only pages of instructions. The last 10 or so pages featured hollowed-out recesses which contained devices that were far too deep to have fitted in the book. One of the pages contained a device similar to a flare gun, which had Mark IV text marker written on its side. Another page had a glass panel covering a handle like a fire alarm. A note painted on the glass read, "In unprecedented emergency, asterisk, break glass." The asterisk, I noted somewhat chillingly, related to the footnote. Please note, personal destruction does not count as an unprecedented emergency. I was just learning about how writing brief descriptions of where you are by hand to enable you to get back, page 136, when it was time to clock off. I joined the general exodus and wished Bowden good luck with his routine. He didn't seem in the least nervous, but then he rarely did. I got home to find my landlord on my doorstep. He looked around to make sure Miss Havisham was nowhere in sight, then said,
"Time's up next."
"You said Saturday," I replied, unlocking the door.
"I said Friday," countered the man.
"How about I give you the money on Monday when the bank's open?"
"How about if I take that dodo of yours and you live rent-free for 3 months?"
"How about you stick it in your ear?"
"It doesn't pay to be impertinent to your landlord next. Do you have the money or not?"
I thought quickly.
"No,
but you said Friday and it's not the end of Friday yet. In fact, I've got over 6 hours to find the cash." He looked at me, looked at Pickwick, who had popped her head round the door to see who it was, then at his watch.
"Very well," he said, "but you better have the cash to me by midnight sharp or there'll be serious trouble."
And with a last withering look, he left me alone on the landing. I offered Pickwick a marshmallow in a vain attempt to get her to stand on one leg. She stared vacantly at me, so after several more attempts, I gave up, fed her, and changed the paper in her basket before calling Spike at SO27. It wasn't the perfect plan, but it did have the benefit of being the only plan. So on that basis alone, I reckoned it was worth a try. I was eventually patched through to him in his squad car. I related my problem, and he told me his freelance budget was overstuffed at present as no one ever wanted to be deputized. So we arranged a ludicrously high hourly rate and a time and place to meet. As I put the phone down, I realized I had forgotten to say that I preferred not to do any vampire work. What the hell? I needed the money.